Welcome, friends. Today on the show, we have Tom Blakey. He is a British parachute veteran who is a prolific YouTuber, survivalist, bushcraft, and events runner. I was wondering if you could give us a little introduction to your background.
Hi there. So I served for 25 years, regular army in a parachute regiment, and around about half of that I was in the Pathfinders, which is a reconnaissance unit that's sort of quite an elite unit within the British Army. Specialised in high altitude parachuting quite a bit, also survival, and I was a forward air controller as well, which meant I was talking to aircraft and guiding them to actually drop weapons on targets. I was a jungle warfare instructor too, and a few other bits and pieces. And I did 7 operational tours, so went away on operation 7 times. Kosovo, Macedonia, Northern Ireland, Afghanistan a few times, and Iraq as well. I left the army, the regular army, in 2014. Then I joined the reserves for a few years. And I recently left. So I left completely about a year ago. I'm now actually working at a school, training the cadets within school. So a combined cadet force. So I'm still wearing uniform, but I'm no longer actually currently serving within the army as such.
Wow, your cadets are so lucky to have someone of your caliber teaching them.
Yeah, well, doing their admin for them at least, anyway.
I used to be in the Air Force cadets for about 3 or 4 years.
All right, yeah. I started my time off there in the Army cadets too before I joined the Army. I was actually joined at 16, so quite early on, and then cracked on for another 25, finished my entire lot.
Yeah, I was from the age of, I think, 13 to 15. I was in 13 to 16 or something like that.
Yeah, that's exactly what I did in cadets too.
I got a bit delusioned of it because I joined to basically fly planes a lot. But I think my time there, I was up on a glider once. I was in a Cessna once. Yeah. I went shooting 3 or 4 times. And the rest of the time, it was basically being bullied by the NCOs.
Yeah. Standing in lines and getting shouted at.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
And coming home wearing those marching shoes after 3 hours and feeling the carpet on my feet and just like feeling I'm floating on pillows, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So what are the, I've never heard of the Pathfinders before. What's
So basically the Pathfinders are a reconnaissance unit that works specifically for 16 Air Assault Brigade. So you've got the whole airborne brigade. So you've got several battalions of infantry. Then you've got all the supporting arms. So the Pathfinders basically are the reconnaissance element for that entire brigade. And they specialize in high altitude insertion. So hey ho and hey lo. They'll parachute in behind enemy lines, identify targets, potentially take on high-value targets, ambushes, and using forward air controllers and snipers to take out those targets. And then once the main force comes in via the parachute or helicopter or whatever else, whatever other means, they'll set up the landing zones and stuff for those and guide the main troops on towards the targets that they've already done the reconnaissance on. So quite a specialised unit. Very, very similar to Special Forces, but they don't come under the Special Forces bracket.
So what can you teach on your events to the general public?
Yeah, so I set up an events company a couple of years ago. It's still, you know, getting building at the moment, but it's really going in the right direction. So that's called First In Events. And basically what I've done, First In is the motto of the Pathfinders. So I called it First In Events. And what I'm doing is all the kind of military themed stuff. So last weekend, I ran a fan dance over the Brecon Beacons. That's a Pathfinder and Special Forces selection test. So you go over Penifan twice and you do 24 kilometres carrying 35 pounds on your back. Then I run bushcraft and survival weekends. So that's just learning all the basic skills that we learned on the SEER courses and stuff. Obviously not giving away any secrets, but just learning your basic survival and bushcraft bits and pieces. Also run a navigation weekends and days. And the other thing I do is organise tandem skydiving days as well. So that's kind of like a halo, hey-ho type scenario type stuff as well.
So what kind of people are going in for this long marches?
There's a whole combination of people as it goes. It's quite diverse. So you get a lot of people that are military kind of fanatic type people, or I wouldn't say fanatics, but, you know, interested in that sort of stuff. So they'll watch, say, the programme on the telly, the old SAS Who Dares Wins, and they'll be like, God, I'd really like to try something like that, you know, maybe read the books and stuff. But then you've got people that are just generally into the fitness. You've got trail runners and stuff, because you don't have to wear the rucksack. You can do it clean fatigue as well, so as a runner. And all sorts, you know, we had an army cadet do it just recently. He was only 16 years old and he was carrying the weight, 35 pound plus water, and he actually completed the event. So, you know, well done to him. And people do it for charity and all sorts of stuff. Last weekend, though, we actually had the sister of a good friend of mine who was killed in action. So he was in the Pathfinders with me. Some of your viewers might know his name, Brian Budd. He won the Victoria Cross in 2006 and he was killed whilst during the action. Her sister actually done it in his memory last weekend. So that was absolutely amazing. And she's a tiny little thing, you know, there's nothing to her. But she was carrying the weight, 35 pound plus the water. She had a couple of bricks in her Bergen to make the weight up as well. And she cracked it. She got over the hills and she finished the event. And she was quite emotional, but it was really nice to see her.
Congratulations. Yeah. So what do you do to people? What happens to people that come there? They're not ready. Their fitness is way. Do you have like a test to actually do this march?
No, they have to sign a medical waiver and declare anything that they may have, you know, any medical issues. So we kind of covered that before they started. But there's no test. It's just, you know, it's their own kind of choice to do it. But what we do have is a 3-hour cutoff at the turnaround point. Because basically you go over the route once, turn around and come straight back the way you've just come, which is pretty much demoralizing when you're on the way back, to be honest, because you're going over the highest point of the Brecon Beacons twice. But if they don't get to the turnaround point in 3 hours, we stop them there because otherwise it's going to take them forever to get back if it's taken 3 hours to make the first part of the route.
So in terms of bushcraft and survival, I was never into this stuff until after Russia invaded, and then all of a sudden I became like obsessed with it. It's like, yeah. But I never kind of like, I just wanted to learn some basic survival stuff. I mean, I always kind of liked Bear Grylls and Rainiers and stuff like that. But
yeah,
I think I ordered some Chinese knife, 440C steel. And then I just went out and started doing stuff with this bushcraft knife. And then I just like got obsessed with the whole thing. And then that's how I discovered your YouTube channel.
Yeah.
So bushcraft and survival is such a huge topic that you could do PhDs in like botany and, so that would be like useful survival skills. Just learning about trees and the wood, that's, you know, just to learn about one tree is almost a week's course, or just, you know, the amount of just spending time with the wood and learning what you can do with it. So I'm interested to know, given this is such a big topic, on a bushcraft weekend, what can people actually learn?
Yeah, I mean, obviously you're only going to brush over each subject. So we'll cover a various subjects within the weekend. So, you know, fire lighting, purifying water, building shelters, survival priorities, navigation, signaling, all that sort of stuff. You're never going to, over 2 days, you're never going to have enough time to kind of learn it in depth. But what we will do is we'll give people the basics. We'll show them different methods, ways to do things and all that sort of stuff. And the things that you may not have thought of, you know, there's everyday things that you can use for stuff like purifying your water and for starting fires and for building shelters that people may not have thought of. So it's just about kind of introducing people to it, showing people some ideas and then putting it into practice as well. So we're not just putting the stuff out and saying, yeah, this is how you do it. We, you know, go through little exercises so they can practice actually doing things like the purifying the water and starting fires and stuff like that. And it's great life skills, isn't it? I mean, I wish I'd had the opportunity to do it when I was younger. I just didn't. Back then, back in the 80s, I suppose it wasn't quite as easy to find out information about stuff because you didn't have the internet. But, you know, it's great to be able to bring this sort of stuff to the general public and kind of give them the benefit of many, many years of experience without trying to sound too big-headed. You know, I've done this stuff for a long time, and so have the staff that I use. I use genuine people that have got very good backgrounds in the various subjects that I cover. Mm-hmm.
What I find about bushcraft and survival is that it's so humbling how vulnerable we are as humans out in the wild without like materials.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the actual, I mean, we all just basically take everything for granted nowadays, don't we? All the technology we've got and the fact that, you know, most of us that are lucky enough anyway, live in nice, decent, heated houses with water on tap, literally, electricity on tap and the rest of it. And when it comes down to the basics, most people haven't got a clue about doing, you know, fending for themselves, basically being self-reliant.
Yeah, I think most people in the West would basically I don't know how long they'd last if they had to flee their homes and there wasn't somebody taking them in as refugees, like just out in Scotland. Like, how long would people last out in the wild?
Yeah. Yeah, it's lost skills. I mean, you know, it's stuff that people used to have to use to survive. And some people still obviously do around the world, but a very, very small percentage in comparison. And that, you know, those skills seem to have been lost pretty much forever in the Western world, at least, in the vast majority, at least.
Yeah. I sort of have replaced my sort of entertainment, gaming and watching movies with like real life LARPing, doing bushcraft, things like that. And I kind of excuse it to myself. It's like a game, but I'm coming away with benefits with it, you know? So
yeah.
That's what it's like to me.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I mean, it's nice to be able to develop stuff, isn't it? Learn new skills, develop them, practice them. And it is, you know, as I said, it's life skills, isn't it? It's something that you may never have to use it, but one day if you did need it, you've got that in your back pocket and you've practiced it, you know, to actually help make your life either a bit easier, a bit more comfortable, or save your life.
So I was watching one of your videos and I sort of plagiarized one of your ideas, but then I went back to your video and realized I hadn't actually plagiarized anything. I just made a slight device. So I've got this, what do you think of my EDC necklace, which has a signal mirror, it has a lighter with some Kevlar cord wrapped around it. It's got some liquid skin super glue and a small knife that my friend Don from America gave me, made in America, and a fire steel.
Yeah, it's not bad. Not bad at all. It's probably annoying the hell out of you after 10 minutes.
Yeah. What annoys me was basically the tape is catching the hairs on my chest. Yeah. So every time I'm walking around, I feel this thing there. But it's actually a bit of a weight as well on my neck. And
yeah. What I would say is something like that, I would go for smaller items and something that was maybe slightly different. I'd personally go for navigation. So I'd go for a small button compass. I'd go for a whistle and a torch. But, you know, if I was going to make a necklace up, there'd be a couple of things that I'd have there. Maybe you can even get those tiny little ferro rods, can't you, that you can put on a cord as well. And funny enough,
yeah. I'm getting... There's a ferro rod on this.
Yeah.
See it?
Yeah, seen. I've actually getting some made up with a little survival necklace thing with fishing line in it and all that. And a striker with a ferro rod in it on the end of it too. That's quite a cool little thing. I'll get made up fairly soon, actually. They should be in within, I don't know, next 2 weeks.
Nice one. Now my claim to fame is that, and I swear to God, see that you see this ferro rod with the Gorilla tape on the end of it?
Yeah.
I actually invented that myself. I came up with that idea. I didn't watch any YouTube videos about it. I just thought, this thing's flammable and I can't really get a good grip on this tiny flint.
Yeah, yeah.
So I put that on and I'm like, yeah, that was a good feeling, you know, just to sort of be inventive.
Yeah, yeah. It's nice, isn't it, when you crack something like that and you think, actually, that's a good idea and I thought of that. Yeah.
Yeah. So do you have any plans to sort of write any fiction around this whole survival theme?
Any fiction?
Yeah.
No. But what I do have plans with, and I'm about a third of the way through, is a book about my experiences basically in the military. I have actually started that. I've been encouraged to do that by several people, and I just I found it a bit of a battle kind of writing about myself. It's a bit kind of self-centered, isn't it? But obviously it's not just about me. It's about the experiences and friends and stuff like that as well. And I have actually, I'd say, got about a third of the way through that so far.
The reason that I say like fiction is that some of the best books I've read are written by former military people. There's one by this author, I've forgotten his name. It's called The Lost Fleet. He was a Navy guy.
Right.
He wrote this sort of spaceship battles based on real-time traveling and time delays and like in solar system fightings. And then there's one by another guy, I can't remember his name, it's called 1 Second After, and it's about an EMP strike.
All right.
And that book actually terrified me a little bit because it starts off, I don't actually know if he has a military experience, but somebody in the US Senate or Congress says that everybody in school should read this book.
Yeah.
And basically the scene is like, there's this American guy with the kids and they're waiting for him to come back for a barbecue and there's a motorway nearby. And then all of a sudden, his phone dies on him. And then he's like, they can't hear the cars. The you walk over to the road and there's always like people like standing outside of their cars wondering what's going on, and then it escalates really quickly. And the first time I listen to it, my heart's like this.
Yeah.
You know, it's because the realism of it, you know, and that's why I think like former military guys should always maybe, or some of them is, you know.
Yeah, there's a guy I know who was in Hereford, and he's written a couple of books that he's written as fiction. I think he's done it in a way as to kind of write about some of his experiences without writing about them, if you know what I mean. So it's like, oh no, this is all fiction, but actually some of it's probably based on real incidents and real circumstances.
Yeah. So another problem that I have with this hobby of mine is that I'm just so much gear all over the place, and like,
yeah,
it's where do you keep all this stuff, you know?
Yeah. I have a little bit of that problem as well.
You must have like companies sending you stuff as well.
Yeah, so I've had a few bits and pieces people have asked me to trial and have a look at and stuff. So that's been quite interesting, yeah.
So do you ever like think about worst case scenarios and what you do?
Yeah, to be honest. So yeah, I do, but I like to keep it real as opposed to like the fantasy stuff that a lot of people tend to kind of concentrate on. Just things that could actually happen to you, you know, in your everyday life, or if there was a big disaster of some sort. And I do have a bag packed in my car just in case you get stranded somewhere, you know. I mean, in this country, in the UK, one of the biggest potential threats is just getting stranded in the wilderness somewhere, because I do go out quite a bit to, you know, mountainous regions and stuff. And if you do it in the winter, you know, you could end up, you know, with at the end of a road somewhere, not be able to get out to where you need to get to, whether that's the car breaking down or just the road not being drivable, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one thing. But then, yeah, I like to kind of just keep a bit of a broad sort of spectrum of kit that's not specified for one specific event, but just emergency kit that's going to give you a chance of surviving something if it did kick off.
What's the worst survival situation you've been in, and how did you go about getting out of it?
Well, it depends on which way you look at it, really. Probably the worst one was being stuck in a compound in Afghanistan in 2006. And we basically got trapped there. We was under siege for, I think it was 50-odd days or something. We was only supposed to be there for 2 days, and we ended up being there for nearly 2 months. And every time we were supposed to be leaving, the time got extended and extended and extended. It just kept going. And we were getting attacked every day, sometimes two or three times a day, mortars and all sorts of things. So not like a pure survival as in what most people think, as in, you know, living in the woods, but actually surviving, you know, by the hair, you know, skin of your teeth, basically getting attacked every day and stuff. But we were actually practicing survival stuff in there, because the RAF actually couldn't fly helicopters into where we were, because I was worried about getting shot down. So we ran out of food and stuff, and we were butchering goats and living off local food and goats and stuff like that for here and there. So there was some survival stuff going on. It wasn't just the fighting as well.
So how did you get the goats without being shot?
Because they were in our compound.
That must have been pretty big compound then.
Yeah, it was pretty big. It was the district centre. It was the old police station of the town, Musicala. And, you know, that's how they live over there. They had some kind of livestock within the walls of the police station, you know.
Yeah. Well, it's a great thing to have. I mean, yeah. How many more days could you have survived there without having to venture outside the compound for food?
Well, we were venturing outside because you can't just stay inside. We were patrolling. So if you stay within the compound, then you give the enemy freedom of movement. So that means that they can basically creep up on you and start, you know, setting up devices and IEDs and planning attacks and stuff. So we weren't just staying within the compound. We were patrolling every day, which is obviously dangerous, but it's more dangerous if you don't. So when we were out and about, we were collecting resources and stuff too.
Were you eating any fauna or insects?
No, nothing like that. They didn't quite get to that point.
That's what I want to learn about next, is how to basically survive off limited vegetables that are around, and also insects.
Yeah,
like I think insects have the most largest biomass, and so that seems like it's the, like, because like in Scotland, like there's not that many squirrels to go around. There's not that many foxes to go around. Most of the protein that I would get would basically be earthworms and digging up. I would probably spend a lot of time digging up insects.
Yeah.
And just to survive and then just frying them.
Yeah.
And if I can get a metal pot. But I sort of play back all these scenarios in my mind and I sort of have this obsession about what would I do if there was, if I didn't have a knife or I didn't have a pot. These are the sort of like Stone Age type things. So
yeah.
The moment I'm trying to work out how I boil water without a metal pot, which is quite an advanced item in the grand scheme of life.
Yeah. Some of the countries I've been to outside of operations as well, though, we did various survival training packages, places like Kenya, Botswana, Brunei. And, we got to eat some interesting stuff in those places. Managed to catch a snake when I was in Brunei, and then we ate that. Botswana managed to eat, what was it, the big millipedes, these big millipede things. Flipping awful. Tastes horrible.
I think that's one of the worst ones you could eat.
Yeah, they were pretty awful. Grubs, fried up some grubs and stuff like that. But to be honest, you know, when you get over that thing of, oh, it looks horrible, it's not, it doesn't look like fish and chips, you know, most of the things, they tend to taste all right. Obviously, most meat tends to taste like chicken anyway, so it's just getting over that. And once you, if you haven't eaten for a day or two, then you'll eat anything anyway, to be honest.
Well, crickets have got higher protein content than chicken and things like that, and there's less that can go wrong with insects because the parasites and diseases that affect insects don't affect humans.
Yeah, so safer in the long run.
Well, there is some kind of theory, I don't know if it's conspiracy or not, that if one of those viruses that infect insects and make them do like wacky things like zombify them, if that mutated and infected humans, it would be like one of the worst diseases in mankind's ever had. Like
mega zombie apocalypse inbound.
Yeah, it's fungus. There's like, yeah, just Google like human fungus zombie.
Yeah.
And you're like, whoa, this could be really bad, you know, so I'd rather Bill Gates worry about that one instead of all these ones he's been worrying about recently.
Yeah.
He says some things that just sound so wacky, man. Like, if we do a really good job, we can reduce the population by 10%. I just like, he probably watched that video and goes like, why did I go and say that? You know?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a bit extreme.
Yeah. Why are people so apathetic when it comes to just bushcraft survival? Why do people think we're crazy?
Well, I think, you know, a lot of it is just everyone's used to their easy lives and stuff. And it kind of, it's a little bit of kind of jealousy, I think, in the back of the mind. Like, you know, those guys are making me look bad because if I ever had to do something like that, I'd be totally screwed. I wouldn't have a clue what I was doing. So maybe a little bit of that kind of thing.
I mean, it isn't really a macho thing because there is some like muscle memory for like how to make feather sticks. You know, manipulating saws and things like that. It does take a little bit of strength, but you can build that up like going to the gym. A lot of that stuff that people do in the gyms anyway is not really that useful in terms of cutting wood and whatever, but your body will adapt pretty quickly to those kind of skills. And the only thing about bushcraft that's dangerous is the amount of cuts that you can give yourself. You don't have to use knives properly, you know?
Yeah. Especially if you're not used to using knives and bladed objects. You can hurt yourself really easily, and you know the thing is, if you get complacent, you will get hurt. But it's a lot of it's to do with thinking about what you're going to do before you do it, using the proper techniques, and just be careful, basically wearing gloves, things like that. You know.
Yeah. So I wasn't using gloves because I wanted to develop sort of calluses in my skin, but which helped me once I cut my finger here, that had enough calluses that it wasn't that bad. But then when I had this Chinese knife that didn't lock, pen knife, and I was trying to... It came back on top of me and it cut almost half my finger at the top there, sliced through it there. And this seemed like 3 or 4 millimeters of skin like separated. But the thing is, I'd learned some bushcraft and some... So I've learned some medical stuff. And thankfully, I had one of these liquid skin type super glues on me, the medical grade stuff. And that really helped. Otherwise, I would have probably needed stitches or something like that, or the bandage would have taken ages.
Yeah.
So just having a little bit of medical knowledge as well.
Exactly, yeah. You don't need to be a doctor, but just know a few basics and, you know, be prepared to use it and have some just basic kit on you. Whenever I'm out doing bushcrafty stuff, I've actually put together a belt. I did a little video on it on one of my on my channel. One of the main things on there is the med kit. That's one of the main things I'm carrying. It's just a little bit of trauma, you know, control in case you do have a bad accident with an axe or a chopper.
An axe. Yeah. I'm terrified of blades and stuff because I'm being humbled by how pathetically fragile my body is.
Yeah.
And just even that small knife, like, it's still a bit sore there. And like, when you just look at an axe and what it can do to wood, and so you could just imagine that hitting your arm or an artery. It's like,
yeah, it's your legs that you got to be worried about, isn't it? If you're using an axe, and obviously there's some big areas on your leg where you can lose a lot of blood really quickly. So I always carry a tourniquet, a compression bandage, and a load of other sort of trauma related stuff. Plus, obviously, your little bits and pieces like the plasters and that, just in case.
Yeah, even another humbling thing is, even if you have a tourniquet, and even if you can cut and stop your leg bleeding, you still need surgery, and that is like, you need a hospital, you need a hospital bed, you need all that technology to survive, you know.
And I see a lot of people putting out videos on YouTube talking about medical type stuff, as in, well, not medical training, but, you know, bushcrafters and stuff, saying, oh, I'm carrying this tourniquet, but mate, have you ever actually put a tourniquet on? Do you know what you're doing? And also, do you know the right situation to put them on? Because if you put a tourniquet on a leg or an arm, there's a good chance you're going to lose that arm or the leg if it's on too long. So, you know, you've got to weigh up the fact, do you need to do it to save that life? Is it bad enough? Or if you just had a bit of a gash, you know, you're not just going to chuck it on. So you need to know what you're doing with this kit, because you can do more harm than good sometimes with medical stuff.
Yeah, I think everyone should carry a tourniquet, and I'd say the most people I know, they don't have a first kit in their house, so a tourniquet is a good start. But sometimes those paramedics will be like, don't use a tourniquet in most situations. You could use gauze like that. But then people don't know what gauze is.
Yeah. It needs to be life-saving to, you know, it needs to be a very serious injury that's going to result in you bleeding to death to put a tourniquet on, or, you know, traumatic amputation, something like that, you know, like a blast injury or something. Because if you've lost your foot, and you, well, what you got to do is stop that blood leaking out to save your life.
Yeah. I don't know, like, we have these sort of field hospitals that we have in the military. Even in Ukraine, you have this advanced technology. Imagine what it was like in, like, Roman times when they're fighting wars there, like, the sort of, like, minimalistic things that they could do to, like, what were hospitals like in Roman times? Like, how did they do the most minimal stuff?
It would have been gruesome, wouldn't it? I mean, the doctors back then were known for their strength. They had to be, because they were manually sawing limbs off and stuff in those kind of scenarios. You know, imagine having to do that.
That sounds like probably it was an infected wound that would have to do that.
Yeah, and you can imagine the casualty rate. You know, well, the mortality rate would have been enormous back then. So any kind of sort of fairly serious injuries, probably going to die, you know. So, serious shit.
I think in an ideal situation, we'd all be walking around with, like, halo armor on. This, you know? That would be safe bushcraft.
Yeah, but you know for a fact it'd be like the Stormtroopers, where you're walking around with all this clunky crap on it, it doesn't do anything. You get shot and you get hit anyway.
Yeah, the halo armor does have a lot of weak points. So you feel, it's like, imagine some 50 cal hitting one of those grooves and then it bounces off and hits that flexible bit, you know, so.
Well, as someone that's worn body armor on operations, it's not fun. You know, you want it on when you're getting shot at, but the rest of the time you can't wait to get it off. It's not fun wearing that crap.
Yeah, body armor is one of those things where humanity has a long way to go.
Yeah.
Because you're wearing something that protects a tiny fraction of your whole body. You'd think that we would invent something that could stop projectiles, you know, so in a dense format, but no, we haven't really. I guess maybe graphene could be a good potentiality.
Yeah, you know? Who knows? But yeah, there's a long way to go with that yet, I think.
I had a couple of guys on my podcast about 2 months ago from there, were working in Afghanistan, and one of the guys says that he'd lost about an inch of height due to the just wearing body armor on all these road trips.
Yeah, I mean, when we were out there, it's not just the body armor, it's everything that you carry. We were carrying an average of around about 90 to 100 pounds. And, you know, you're walking around in 40 to 50 degree heat.
100 pounds?
Yes, yeah, about 90 to 100 pounds, yeah, of kit. So you've got your body armor, your helmet, your weapon, your ammunition, your water. You've got ammunition for support weapons. You've got ladders. You've got radios. You've got batteries for radios. You've got ECM and everything else. Food, you know, it's ridiculous. So you're struggling to walk, let alone run, you know. And there were so many people getting injuries that are non-combat related. So just jumping across a ditch and you dislocate your flipping ankle or something, or, you know, people breaking their legs, you know, because the amount of weight and stuff that they were carrying.
Distress fractures.
And actual breaks as well. So we're having, you know, jumping over compound walls and stuff with that amount of kit on your back.
Compound walls? What? So they didn't take the bag off?
Well, you might do, but you might not. And also, you know, if you're under fire, you ain't got time to mess around getting kit on and off. You've literally got to get over. You're basically climbing up a ladder, jumping off the other side. You could land, say, you know, 6 foot down, bust your ankle. Mm. There's all sorts of stuff like that.
Afghanistan.
There's guys getting hernias, you know.
Yeah.
They've strained themselves so much from all the kit they're carrying.
There's some very angry people in the military due to that withdrawal in Afghanistan. Do you think that was a big mistake, the way we withdrew?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the Americans, that they obviously led that, and it was a bit of a mess, wasn't it? I think we were quite lucky that there wasn't more of a drama of us coming out of that place, I've got to say. I think the Taliban just wanted us out, so they let us go. If they kind of went for it, it could have been a massive mess. And it was, you know, there was a few incidents with IEDs and stuff. But it could have been, it was a very tricky operation that. Quite a few friends of mine were involved in that from Tupara. And I think that was quite a dodgy operation that.
Was there no way around it based on what troops you had on the ground?
No, it was basically, it happened so quickly, didn't it? Because the Americans just basically said, right, we're going. So it wasn't like a planned thing of gradually withdrawn or anything. I mean, we did over a certain amount of years, and then we just went, we're going. And it was, yeah, it looked like it was a bit of a mess, to be honest. But quite lucky, like I say, it could have been a lot worse than what it was.
I just can't imagine, like, imagine losing your family member in that war and then just withdrawing like that. You just must be so angry.
Yeah. And you feel sorry for the people left back there, you know?
Yeah.
Because the people that you work with, people that have kind of worked with the NATO troops and stuff, they're going to get smashed. You know, the Taliban aren't going to show that because they don't want any bad press, but they will, you know, they're going to be, there have been executions all over the place.
Mm-hmm. I'm so proud to see a lot of British people out there training in Ukraine, helping the guys, and proud of Britain. Been the first with many things, you know, the javelins and challengers.
Getting the tanks over there, the challengers was an awesome thing because it then enabled the Germans to then get on board, which then enables the other European countries that have got the Leopard 2s under license from Germany to then donate them too. So I think it was a great thing that Britain did that, especially with the challengers. And there's obviously loads of British volunteers over there too. Mm-hmm. And the support, I mean, I hope it's felt over there, but the support in the UK is massive, as you know, from being back in Scotland and stuff. You know, there's still flags up everywhere, Ukrainian flags. I was in a shop just today, and a guy was selling Ukrainian badges there, and he had little flags up and posters and stuff. You see it all over the place. So it's really great that there's moral support and material support as well for that country.
I've seen more Ukrainian flags in Scotland than anywhere else. I haven't seen hardly any Ukrainian flags in Austria. But every time I see a Ukrainian flag in Scotland, it makes me really happy.
Yeah, it's nice, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's nice. I mean, like I say, apart from anything else, there's moral support there, you know, as well as the material. So it's nice that they've got that backup, that support from the people. And it is just your average everyday people as well. It's not just a party line thing, you know.
It must be so stressful for the guys in Ukraine, like, that just have this weight over their shoulder, like, when am I going to be called up, sent to the front line? It's just... So many people never wanted to be in the military, so I can't really imagine the pressure they're feeling right now. Even though I'm here, people are not really going to open up that much.
As I mentioned a second ago, there's loads of Brits over there, as you know, fighting as well. There's a good friend of mine who's just gone back over to Ukraine after being over there since pretty much the very start of the war. He came back home, I think, in November, something like that. So he was over there for quite a long time, came home. Felt like he was kind of not getting anywhere in the UK because he'd lost his passport in the fighting over there.
Yeah.
And he couldn't get established back in the UK on any of the systems and stuff. felt really let down. So he just said, you know what, I'm going back. I felt more valued there than I did in the UK. So he's now gone back over there, and he's not a young guy. He's like 50-odd, 51, 52. And he's joining a fighting unit again, and he was in the front line the whole time he was over there.
Legend. Absolute so, legend.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I just hope he doesn't use up all his luck, because he's probably used up most of his lives already.
Why on earth would the UK treat him so bad after doing what he's doing here? Like this, I don't know what's going on in the UK right now. Like the pound's falling, people are striking.
Yeah.
I mean, get their act together, UK, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And it's a shame because, you know, the people are good. It's just a lot of the sort of the head shared basically in the government and stuff that are messing things up. I mean, like the military, for a start, anyone that served in the military will tell you our army and our military are now at its lowest point it's ever been at, specifically because of what's going on in Ukraine, because we're sending so much out there, we've weakened ourselves. But just the way that the army's been degraded and the military's been degraded over the years, cut in numbers, we are so small now, it's unbelievable.
Well, I think a generation has been inspired. Like, I don't feel as... I feel much more inspired now about the British military than I did when I was a kid, you know. It's just seeing all these heroes in Ukraine giving their lives up, the British, you know, training Ukrainians and that. I think the UK's recruitment problems are pretty much solved as long as we get rid of all this sort of pansying and wokeness out of the recruitment. You know, it's just China and Russia are laughing at us, basically. Even America, you see all this nonsense about hurting your feelings and stuff.
Yeah.
We get nothing. When I was in the ATC, nobody cared about your feelings. You know, nobody...
No. Yeah, I mean, I joined up in it 6 years after the Falklands. So I joined up in 1988. Most of my instructors were Falklands veterans that have, you know, been right at the front of the Falklands. And if you've read up on anything that happened over there, it was mega hardcore, mega. I mean, there were guys, you know, bayonet charging, flipping at night, middle of firefights, you know, 17-year-olds. There was young lads of 17 in the middle of that. British, I'm talking about, not the Argentinians. Getting in amongst it at night, bayoneting people, stuff like that. After walking to 70 miles with £100 on their back, by the way. So those guys that were my instructors were mega, mega hardcore. No messing at all. And you didn't even have to mess up to get a punch in the face. They just beat the crap out of us. And I joined up when I was 16. So pretty tough kind of introduction to the military. But they were mega instructors and mega soldiers.
Yeah, that Afghanistan was a genius play by the UK. I believe we went around the back of the island, disembarked where the people weren't expecting, and then marched over those mountains. And
Yeah.
I think they surrendered eventually.
Yeah, it was a close run thing though, Falklands, because we lost nearly all our helicopters in one hit. The Atlantic conveyor got hit with an Exocet missile and went down with virtually all the Chinooks on board by one. And that was meant to be the means of transport to get across the islands. So they ended up having to walk most of it, most of the troops. And there was a lot of mess ups because that was the first war we'd fought since Korea, proper war. And a lot of mistakes were made. But you know, the guys came through at the end of it and you know, achieved something that nobody thought we'd be able to do, to be honest. It was amazing.
Mm-hmm. So how do you feel like Ukraine is going to do with these Challenger tanks? Because like from the alternative sources, I also watched the pro-Russian side as well, and some of these American guys, that they did take delight in rejoicing against Ukraine's difficulties, and you hear them mocking these tanks that get sent over and say now not really the Challenger, but the Abrams tank has a jet engine and fuel, and the Challenger tank has all its, you know. Do you think that these Challenger tanks are actually going to do anything because of logistical challenges that they're going to have, or do you think it's just a sort of...
I think that the British sending the Challengers over, it was more of a political thing to enable the Germans to then say, right, well, they've done it and it's going to be difficult for us to not do it now. And that then opened up the fact that the Germans can then say yes to the other countries, all the other countries in NATO that use the Leopard 2 as well, that are under warranty, whether it is lease or something from Germany, to then push their tanks through. So it wasn't so much the fact that we've sent, 14 Challengers. That's not an awful lot. They are awesome vehicles, really potent. But as you say, it's the logistical problems they're going to have because they use different ammunition to the other tanks and all the rest of the parts on the vehicles are going to be different. they're great tanks on their own, but the small amount that we've sent is probably going to cause them more logistical problems than the effect they'll have. But it's the bigger picture that they've opened up that's pretty much pushed Germany into doing what they've done. So it was a great thing that the Britain did to enable the rest of the countries to then join in, basically, and contribute. And those Leopards, awesome tanks, the Leopard 2, and they will make a big difference, for definite.
Isn't it just fascinating that we don't have a British Empire anymore, but basically the whole world a lot of times just watches to see what Britain does, and Britain makes the first move, and then America and Germany are copying us with the tanks.
It is true, you know. You know, I know I'm going to be biased because I'm British, but we do still have a big sway in the world. Yeah. Such a small country, geographically speaking, the size of the country, we still do have quite a big impact in the rest of the world. It's good to see that we still do have that influence. Certainly within Europe, you know, we're definitely one of the big hitters, I'd say. It's just a shame that the military has been degraded so much in its size, though, because that's going to have an effect, you know. We couldn't fight the Falklands War today.
Do you even think we have the money to build up a military again? Because, like, look at the amount of strikes that are going on and people... Yeah, I mean, how can we afford on a bit of better military?
Yeah, I mean, most countries, including Britain, are strapped, aren't they? And it's just down to funding a lot of the time. That's what it's all about, you know. And the fact is that people have started... And one thing that... one of the effects that the Ukrainian war has had is woken people up to the fact that the wars aren't just fought by people pressing buttons anymore. Like, people just imagine by playing all these games and watching TV programs and films that it's all about cyber, it's all about pressing buttons, technology and all this sort of stuff. Actually, wars will always be fought by physical things like, you know, the blokes on the ground, the soldiers on the ground digging trenches, sticking bayonets in each other, firing missiles at each other, driving tanks and eat each other and all that sort of stuff, you know. So it still shows, it's gone to show that I think it's woken a lot of people up, actually, to the facts of the real realities of war. There is places for technology, and it is, you know, there's more things being developed. Specifically, drones is a big one in Ukraine. But there's always going to be those poor bastard infantry digging trenches and shooting each other from short distances and closing with each other.
I'm not so sure, man. I mean, I understand as a veteran you're saying that, but like when you just watch these videos, these drones flying around, and I'm actually shocked at some of the videos I can actually sit and watch now. I'm almost desensitized to it. They basically, these heat-seeking drones, and they just drop these grenades on people. It's like, I don't really think there's much of a future for the human. I mean, it just seems like such a waste of life that's going on there. It's so inefficient. We're basically pockets of meat running around with these massive mortars and mitrailleuses flying around. And when you look at the development of AI and just the technology changing, it's like,
yeah, I mean, there's got to be soldiers to take that ground. You can't just have technology taking ground. It's never going to happen. You've got to have people on the ground to move into it, secure it, and then someone else has got to come back and take it off them, and so on and so on, backwards and forwards. Obviously, there's all the places for the technology to enable that to happen, but it's never just going to be drones and just going to be people pressing buttons.
Well, I think for the foreseeable future, it'll be a sort of hybrid, because the human has the best awareness on the ground at the time they can hear. But as technology gets better and better and better, you're going to be able to have a augmented reality suits where you can almost be in the field, feel, and you can see around as good as you could hear or better, but you're not actually physically there. That's going to be very expensive, of course, but
yeah, and that's what's
you can see that there's a sort of range of time before you get to that point. Because in air superiority, a lot of these, you know, the more maneuverable you are, the more you can survive. And eventually the human body won't be able to take those G-forces to be competitive. So I think humans won't be in jet fighters for much.
Yeah, well, that's what they've said. This is the last generation of fighters. It's just coming out now that's going to be manned by people, yeah.
But Tempest.
The other thing you've got to think about with warfare is it's never always going to be peer on peer. So you've got warfare that's going to be fighting guerrillas like we were in Afghanistan for so many years, and to a degree in Iraq as well, and also going all the way back to Vietnam and way, way, way before that as well. So all this technology doesn't always work when you come to fighting, you know, guerrillas out in the hills, and when they're mixed in and amongst the local population. They can actually defeat that technology by just blending in.
Mm-hmm. So what do you see the once this war finishes, do you think that Ukraine and experience will be useful? Maybe it'll be Ukrainians over the UK training people.
Yeah, I mean, it remains to be seen, doesn't it, where this is all going to go. It really does. But yes, I do think it's like any war. It not just for warfare's sake, but for lots of reasons, it develops things, doesn't it? Like the First and the Second World War were massive, the technological development, both of those wars. And again, like I say, not just for weapons, you know, like space travel for a start, you know, the motor vehicles, the medical training and medical development. So it ends up being quite a good sort of movement forward in all sorts of fields as well. But yeah, well, it remains to be seen, I think, but it's definitely shown, I think, both sides of technology and non-technology. I think it's been, this war has shown quite a lot in both sides, I think.
I just want to tell my listeners, pitch Tom's YouTube channel, Prepared Pathfinder. It's probably one of the best British YouTube channels in terms of bushcraft survival and gear. A lot of people, even around the world, look to Tom's videos, and because the British military has held in great respect, even in America and many nations. So definitely check out Tom's YouTube channel. And if you ever get a chance to go to one of his events, I thoroughly recommend it, because even though, you know, you're going to have to pay for it, you're going to learn this stuff a lot quicker in a lot better environment than doing it yourself. So instead of like myself spending 6 months just trial and error, having somebody show you to do a lot of things, save you a lot of time in the end. So
yeah, save you a lot of less cut fingers and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, that's, it feels so stupid. What's the best injury you've ever given yourself doing bushcraft?
Doing bushcraft?
Yeah.
Cut fingers and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, nothing serious. I've had lots of other injuries doing lots of other things, but not so much in bushcraft. Touch wood.
Yeah. So where are you going to, can you give us any sneak preview of what's going to come up on your YouTube channel?
I've got a few plans for different things. So I did a stealth camping video a couple of weeks ago, which I found a little bit amusing because I've never heard of stealth camping until recently after watching a few videos on YouTube. So it turns out I've been stealth camping all my life because I've been in reconnaissance units where you have to kind of sleep out in places and hide away. Anyway, so we'll probably do more of those because that was really popular. That's had lots of hits, lots of comments. It's been quite popular. So I'm planning on doing some more of those, and I think people quite enjoy that sort of thing. Lots of kit reviews as well. As you've mentioned earlier, I've been getting sent kit to review from some good companies as well. I've had some crappy Chinese companies get in touch, and I've just turned them down because if it's something that I haven't used or I haven't got confidence in that company, I'll just turn it off. I'm not interested. So lots of good reviews and stuff. And I've got a couple of plans for some sort of long through hikes and also some overseas stuff as well. Well, one place I particularly like to go to is Vietnam. My dad served in Vietnam in the 60s. He was in the Australian Army. And I'd love to go over there and do like a good sort of jungle trip over there. So that's in the plan in that one.
Cool. Okay, Tom. Well, it's really awesome to have you on the show.
Cheers, mate.
Hopefully get a chance to meet up in person. And I'll show me my current EDC gear that's British safe that I'll have, which probably can't do much.
Yeah.
But yeah, man, really, really thanks for your time. Anything else you'd like to share with our listeners?
No, that's it. Thanks a lot for having me on. It's been really interesting having a chat with you. And yeah, just like, well, for your listeners, I'd just say stay prepared because, you know, you got to look after yourself. And if worst was to happen, whatever that worst thing is, be ready for it. You know, don't be that person that's just thinking, oh, I hope it'll be okay. It should be okay. Be ready for it because when it comes to it, if something happens, whether it's an accident, whether you get stranded somewhere, whether it's a natural emergency, disaster, you know, you're going to have to be that person looking after yourself and also, more importantly, looking after your family. So be prepared for that.
There we have it, folks. You'll never understand how good this hobby is until you actually start doing it, and you'll never look at the world differently again. You'll be looking at trees and birch bark and thinking, well, I should harvest all that birch bark so I can start a fire with my flint easily.
Exactly, yeah.
How would I help this person there with my tourniquet, or, you know, thinking about what you do to escape some fire or something. So I think it could save lives, you know.
Cheers.
Okay, cool. Well, everybody, thanks for watching Nico's show. That was Tom Blakey, and also known as Prepared Pathfinder YouTuber. And we'll see you again shortly in the Nico's show. Bye-bye.
Cheers, Nico.